What is anxiety and depression from a Vedantic standpoint and from the psychological standpoint? Can knowledge cure all mental illnesses if the cognitive function is there? So anxiety and depression, you know, it depends. Like, anxiety can be, and depression can be chemical, where the system is not producing enough particular chemicals, of too much of others chemicals. And so, like, for instance, a person can be born, or just their constitution can cause them to have a generalized anxiety disorder. It means their body's more or less always feeling anxiety, and it's not that easy to control. It's not like you can just turn it off with meditation or with relaxation exercises. Those help. You know, it's the same with something like a panic disorder, for instance. People find that, for whatever reason, kind of out of the blue, they feel tremendous fear and panic. And we have ways cognitively of really helping with that. You know, like practicing when you're in the middle of that panic attack, catastrophic thinking and labeling it as that, feeling that you're going to die, but labeling it as that, as part of a panic attack, changing the rhythm of your breathing, which changes your chemistry. So there's all kinds of things that we can do to help with that, you know, so you don't necessarily need medication. Some of these things you can learn how to handle, even by changing your own chemistry through the breath and through relaxation and through just cognitive applications that can really help with it. But the question is, why are you getting the panic attack? It's not necessarily proven that there's some psychological precursor to the panic attack, or psychological precursors to why you get overwhelmed with anxiety and that type of thing. And so even though we don't necessarily have psychological precursors, we can still learn how to deal with them cognitively through relaxation techniques, through the way that I'm thinking, deep breathing, even breathing, all of these type of things. And then in some cases, you know, medication is useful. Like, for instance, if you're subject to anxiety attacks or panic attacks, it can be helpful just to carry with you some anti-anxiety medication, you know, like Xanax. There's so many of them, Valium, Xanax, on and on. There's many, many different ones, Ativan. Knowing that, you always have that there to take if you need it, and that helps the anticipatory anxiety that, oh, I'm not going to be able to handle this, or, oh, I'm going to have a panic attack, which kind of sets your system up for having one, you know. The anticipatory anxiety and the fear of having a panic attack is itself very unpleasant. And so if you have carrying, it's almost like a, what do you call it, placebo. It just makes your mind know, okay, that if I have a panic attack, or if I get anxious at night and so I'm not going to be able to sleep through the whole night, I have this and I can take this and it will help me. Then you find that, you know, most of the time you don't need to take it, but you have it there in case you do. So we have these type of ways of dealing with it, you know, but when we can't deal with it, it's nice to have a medication that will help us. You know, and not to believe that every kind of mental ailment that you have, like anxiety and depression, and of course something like bipolar disorder, you know, where you go from manic stages to depressed stages, to think that that's because of something that happened in your childhood, or even schizophrenia, it's not true. You know, there's an imbalance that's taking place, and it's usually found to be hereditary, you know. And so there are things that we can do to help that just have to do with the foods you eat and how you take care of your body, and even yoga and meditation and things like that, and learning how to talk to yourself when you're in the middle of a condition like that. Particular types of breathing exercises, those help, you know. But again, they help because you're dealing with a physiology, you know, in kind of a very naturalist way rather than taking medication. But also the fact that medication is there to take is also kind of a blessing, you know. With depression, everyone gets depressed at times. So with depression, there's a normal range. Say we call this within here. This is the normal range from happiness to depression that people will kind of swing. Sometimes you're happy, sometimes you're kind of depressed, sometimes you're in the middle. But it's not debilitating, and it's not something that you go into a semi-depressed range, or a depressed range that's even within the normal range of people in general, the normal curve. This is their range, the normal curve. So you fall within the normal curve. But say you get there, and then you stay there for months. That's not normal, you know. That's like a cyclothymia. We even have a category for it. It's a mild depression, but then you stay there. And you almost are living in that. So that's... there's things that we can do, like get plenty of sun, get plenty of exercise, even when you're feeling down. You know, do some things that you used to enjoy, you know, which is kind of hard to even make yourself do if you're feeling depressed. But those things actually can help. And you can handle it like that when it's kind of in the normal range. But depression can be really debilitating, where it's just very hard to do anything. You have no energy and you feel down and you see no future. One of the symptoms of depression is that you cannot see your way out of it. When you look into the future, you see nothing but the same. That's a symptom of it. Having suicidal ideation is a symptom of it. No energy, you know, no hope. These are all symptoms. And so when you're overwhelmed by those symptoms, that's tough. You need friends. You need people to get you up and out and walking and get you in the sun and eating well and all of that to try to handle these things naturally. But often, you know, it doesn't work very well. And so there's even some more natural, more herbal medications. I think one is called Sami. There's different ones that you can try, but at some point you might feel that you have to try antidepressants, you know. But even with the antidepressants, I would do everything possible first to change your chemistry or support your chemistry in a natural way through exercise and diet and sunlight. Sunlight is really important, you know. And trying to bring up your mood by your relationship with your friends and things like that. But these depressed states, again, are not necessarily psychological. There can be very much caused by your chemistry, you know. So that's kind of important to know, that not every mood you have is a psychological issue. And then we have moods that are psychological issues, you know. So you have to know that both are there. So from a Vedantic standpoint, when we're talking about psychological issues and not things that are caused by your chemistry, we have more control, because it has to do, both the anxiety and depression have to do with tension or constriction in your mind, you know. And it's usually triggered by your raga dvesha, you know, when your life isn't going as you want it to, your relationship's not going as you want it to, this and that is not going as you want it to. You know, sometimes we don't even think of our attitudes toward as raga dvesha, as my likes and dislikes. But if you really stop and think of it, you know, you can usually see that some sort of disappointment is not is in the play, is in the mix there. Like something about your hopes and aspirations and relationship, whatever, are not being met, you know. Especially about your aspirations, like the things that are really, really important to you. Time or Bhagawan or the universe or whatever, or the people in your life, whatever, are making that, thwarting that, you know. And so then you can feel anxious and constricted and unhappy and kind of imprisoned in a way. I can get all kinds of feelings. And that's that. In that case, that's caused by a lot of tension and stress in the mind. And it really helps if you're with Vedanta to relax and talk to the one who's feeling that way. Really start to understand how you're actually feeling. Let the depressed part of you talk to you, the anxious part of you talk to you. And then so that you can get a more kind of objective, helpful relationship to that part. And then, you know, start to more and more realize that we are in Bhagawan's time. We're living in Bhagawan's time, not in the time of the psyche. So your psyche always wants things, the mind always wants things to manifest and happen much more quickly than they do, you know. And so then we feel anxious and worried and impatient, and I'm not getting anywhere, and all this kind of stuff. So at that time, I think it's really good to do meditations where you're just being with Ishvara. You know that you're, for one thing, your ananda is not dependent on this or that or anything happening, in fact. And what, one thing that Swamiji told me that I think really helps with this, he says, you will get what is yours. In the Prabhu, you'll get what is yours, don't worry. And you won't get what isn't. So if something's not gelling or not happening or not really not unfolding in your life, you know, and you think you want it so much, you know, you have to think, you know, this isn't happening. And even though I want it so much and the door is being slammed in my face, it's probably really a good thing that I'm not getting it. And if you look back in your life, at least if I look back, there's two or three instances where I really wanted something and I really didn't get it. It was like, and it was so shocking. I was so angry. You know, like, how could that be? How could that door be shut, you know, like that? So firmly when I wanted it so badly, you know. But, you know, when I look back, you know, one of these, and these was 20, 30, 40 years ago, more like 40, 50, 40 years, at least 40 years ago, I'd say. Yeah. 40, 45 years ago for some of these big ones, you know. And if those things had worked out, I don't even know who I would be. It wouldn't be me. My life would not have gone the way that it went. You know, so sometimes, who knows why these desires or samskaras rise up and take you over. But if they're not yours, if they're not meant to be, then that's just going to give you a little dukkha for the time being, but it's in your best interest. You know, so having that type of confidence in Ishvara, in your prarabdha, that you will get everything you need, you will get everything that is yours. You have to learn to be patient, because our aspirations don't fulfill themselves immediately, and they might be something that is a hangover samskara or just some fancy, you know, that you have that is not going to be fulfilled. And you have to be able to accept that too and live with it, you know. So, okay, that's karma yoga buddhi. You receive everything as prasad. Yeah. And so then from a Vedantic perspective, dealing with it like that is really helpful. And from a Vedantic perspective, dealing with my physical constitution and its problems, and dealing with my emotional constitution, you know, like, so I've had clients that their psyche is an anxious psyche, it's just full of anxiety and worry a lot. And so their task and what we worked on, you know, is how to be with that, how to live with that, how to be with that anxiety, how to understand it, how to understand it for what it is and not build up anxious layers around it to make matters much more intense, much, much worse. And how to in a sense control it or be in a way that allows it to settle down. And how helpful it is to have a little anxiety pill on the shelf that you can know is always there to take if things get out of control. So I think that's probably all I have to say about it psychologically and through Vedanta. If there's a situation where I act with the best intention and compassion, and later I realize it was a dharma, do I create papa? I don't think so. There's going to be, if it was kind of the wrong choice, you know, then there's going to be a result on this plane. But your intentions were pure. There was no bad intention there. And papa has to do with, in terms of adrishta, it has to do more with intention, you know. And so I doubt that you would accrue papa, even though the thing didn't turn out in the way that you wanted to. An example to support that, of course I have one not to support it too, which I'll tell you. One example is, you know, when I was talking about the surgeon doing the surgery who had every good intention to save the patient's life, but the patient died. That is an example of they're not accruing. Swamiji uses that example, Puja Swamiji, as not accruing papa. Because the intent was very pure, and he was doing his best to save the patient's life. Whereas the opposite example that's given side by side with that is if the person is a robber or a thief, for instance, and they have a knife and they slit open the person, you know, but the intention is certainly not to save that person's life. It's an attack on that person. It's a murder, for instance, of that person, you know, in order to either end the person's life because they're an enemy, or do you take the person's life because you want their wallet or whatever it is. That's a papa. Because that was the intent, was to destroy, to hurt, himsa, you know. Whereas the intent on the part of the doctor was to save and to care for, you know. So one is accruing punya or neutral, and the other is definitely accruing papa. So in this instance, say there's something you do with all love and compassion. And that is your intent, is only to help, and it doesn't work out that way, then that can't be a dharma, according to this example that we use. There's other ways of looking at dharma and a dharma, though, that sometimes our actions, whether we know it or not, are adharmic, even if there's no intent one way or the other to be dharmic or adharmic. The action is adharmic. Like, for instance, they even use an example which is very much like the Jains. You're walking along, you're stepping on many and killing many, many insects, you know. You're not doing that on purpose, but it's still happening. That's an extreme example of accruing papa, because you're killing just unwittingly, not paying attention, you're taking the life of all of these living beings. You're not paying attention, you know. So that can be viewed as a papa. Another thing is that the unnecessary slaughter of animals for your own pleasure, for eating meat, for wearing leather, or using down, all of these things, even though you're unconscious of it, you're actually not letting yourself be conscious of what's going on. There's plenty of opportunity if you were to give it thought of what you are actually participating in, actually doing. And so on a collective social level, it's a huge, unfathomable, really, a dharma, what is being done here. And we don't really have an excuse, because even though the society and our marketing systems, the meat industry, etc., has gone so far out of their way to keep things nicely packaged and show happy chickens in their and their commercials and things like that. They go so far out of their way to make sure that we don't really know what's going on. We do know on some level, but it's so inconvenient to know that we don't let ourselves deal with it, you know. But at some point, we all find that we can't not know, and there's no way, as you face the reality of the situation, that you can continue doing that. That's how adharmic it is. That's how dark it is. Once you wake up to it, you cannot continue. You know? Now the problem is with something like this, which is such a massive adharma. And the more you know about it, the worse it gets. It's such a massive adharma that whole countries are predominant, very heavily involved in this, you know. And actually, the world is being destroyed by it. Our earth is being destroyed by it. What is the major killer of the earth is our consumption of animals. And it's the one thing that is not put on the top. It's now being given some bit of attention. But that it is the primary cause of the problems that we're facing. Very few people, only the most informed people, are even aware of that. But to me, that's how I see it, is an adharmic fallout. We're reaping the earth, and all of us are reaping the result, the karmapala, of this collective adharma, you know. And so we have to speak out against it. We have to realize it in our own heart. Even doing something like wearing leather, having anything to do with any of that, you know, the cruelty and the unnecessary slaughter, you know, the extreme torture that's involved in that with the animals. We do not need any of those products. They're not even good for us. Meat is not good for us. Milk is made, the cow's milk is made for the baby cows, you know. Eggs are ovums. Anyway. You have to let this become conscious enough so that you don't involve yourself in it. And we have to talk about it to other people just for the sake of the world, just to try to lighten the heaviness of the adharma that we find ourselves in. So that's an example of an incredible adharma that we know about but can't face because it's inconvenient. You know? And Margaret Mead, a famous anthropologist, said, you know, it's much easier to change a person's religion than their diet. That is a biggie. That's why there's so much problem in it, because we're addicted to our patterns, our food, and the clothes that we love, and all of these things. It's not an easy thing. So you gave me my little opening for talking. That's what you get. tends to come out whenever I get a little opening. Swamiji used to always do that to us. When I first met Swamiji, he would always somehow find an opportunity in all of his talks going all around, all of the yajnas that he would give, and also in the classes, whenever there's any little opening, he would talk about being a vegetarian. For a good length of time, he would really get into it. So I picked it up from him. Yeah. Sometimes we hurt people despite having followed Dharma and having done the right thing to do. How do you deal with it? What can you still do about it? Well, this is interesting. There's this line to keep in mind. So I'll just tell you about that, and then that helps you to judge how to be in your relationship with others. It's called vak tapas, means the discipline of speech. How we should try to control our speech. So it goes like this. Whatever you say, it should be satyam. Okay? You could say many, many, many things. You know, there's just a plethora of things you can say. But whatever you say, or things that you can think, but make sure that whatever you say is satyam, that it is true. It's the truth. You're not lying. Or just trying to, I don't know, say something that's not really true just to make the other person feel good. It's better not to say anything at all. You don't have to say anything. Just say what is true. But what you choose to say of the things that are true, that are available to you to say, that come to mind to say, they also have to be hitam. Means they have to be helpful, beneficial, you know, worthwhile. Something that's helpful to the person, you know, hitam. But of the things now that are both satyam and hitam, they should also be priyam. Means they should also be pleasing, ahimsa, non-hurtful, caring. Because this is for like probably 99.9% of your interactions. Where that's not going to be the case, it's with, say, your children, it should be satyam and hitam, but sometimes it's not very pleasing, you know, because you're correcting them, and they don't really want to be corrected, you know. But you have to for their well-being, you know, for their well-being, that's your job. And the other is for your teachers. If they are your teacher, if that role is assigned to that person, then what they say should be satyam and hitam, but sometimes there's some correction in it. And there's correction in it because that exists within that role. It should be correction that is still done with kindness and all of that, but it's correction. You may not, may be hurtful to hear it or to know about it, you know. But those are the main people that are kind of given that permission. Your teachers and your parents. Now, say in terms of your actions, and a lot of times your actions involve speech also, and it's in relationship to some other person. In that relationship, is there permission given to the two of you, you know, to behave in that, toward that person in a way that is hurtful, you know? Or is it something like you're just being yourself and following some dharma, whatever it may be, and the fact that you're following that dharma is hurtful to the other person? Then that's kind of irrational, maybe, perhaps on the other person's part, you know? But say within your scope, the way that you're treating the other person is satyam, hitam, and priyam, you know, and you're not speaking unkind words, then still there's going to be problems, you know, but then those problems have to be dealt with. So I don't quite understand, I'm trying to imagine a situation like this. Say, sometimes we hurt people despite having followed Dharma and having done the right thing to do. And so that person may have aspirations for you, what you should do, and what they want you to do, and that's not possible. And so then they will feel hurt because they're their raga is not, you know, their desires are not being met. But then that's a situation that we all have to face, right? Because not everybody, we all know in our own relationships that not everybody does what we want them to do, you know? Because we're not the center. All of their decisions are not about us, you know? And so also that person is very controlling is also a problem. So if people get hurt because their desires are not being met, and there's nothing that you can do about it, because for you to meet their desires and do what they want, you cannot do. It's not possible. And so you both have to go your own ways and heal. Like that. Heal from the trauma. How do you deal with it? What can you still... How do you deal with it? You just deal with it as graciously as you can. What can you still... What can you still do about it? You just do whatever you can without giving up your life and your own karma. Yeah. Just try to understand the other person's problem and be present to talk about it and be a big person and care about the other person, but that doesn't mean that you can do what they want you to do. Sometimes you can't do that. And they can feel very badly and hurt about it. Just like you would feel very badly and hurt when your partner or somebody close to you is not able to do what you want them to do. And they can't do it. And so then say that happens, then hopefully the person who can't do what you really want them and need them to do will spend time with you and kind of try to work it out to the best possible way. But that doesn't mean that they're going to stay. Or that they're going to do what you need them to do, because they can't. You know? And that is samsara in a nutshell. There we have it. Swargaloka, that won't happen. Yeah. I need you to be like this, and of course you are like that. I need you to really love me and desire me and want me, and you do. What are some powerful ways, other than puja ceremonies, to purify the mind? How do you replace pujas? One of the best, I think, that Karma Yoga Buddhi is one of the best ways, because that's, your whole life becomes a puja. Because everything is seen as Ishwara, and everything that comes your way is taken as prasad. And so that means there's always a worship of Ishwara going on. The other way of continual worship of Ishwara, that what we call the Ishwara Arpana Buddhi, is having Dharma. Being in the present is being with Ishwara. Being in your imagination is being with you, is being with your mind, right? Being in the present is being with Ishwara, and then doing what is asked of you. It means, what is your dharma? It's not at all, the whole thing about raga dvesha, that really falls off after some time. It's just simply not important, because what is important is dharma, is the shanti, and just abiding in your own knowledge and being able to be present to what is. What is, what is happening right now, there's plenty to do, there's plenty of people, there's plenty of everything. And it is exactly what is your prarabdha. So there's plenty to do, there's plenty to be present to, you know. So concentrate on doing your duty with what is here right now, and the things that present themselves that have to be done. You do that to the best of your ability. You receive all of the results of your actions as prasad from the Lord. And then, so that's just your day-to-day. And I would look at all of that as a puja. Doing a puja is also beautiful, because it's a ritual, it's a type of meditation to Ishwara. You're sitting and you're doing a particular puja. That's a timeout from your daily life that sets you up for your daily life. You know? it sets you up to take the rest of the day as a puja, because you've taken this meditative time out. And also in your in your daily practice, say your morning practice, as we're doing all of these things, like you invoke the inner friend, and you know, just look at what you have to do today, so that your mind knows that, okay, we know what we have to do, and it can relax then. But then you check in with the little ones inside, and then pray. Just sit before Ishwara, your Ishtadeva or your Ishtadevata, and you just pray. You say, and pray means not chanting those kind of prayers. I love those kind of prayers. I do many of them. It's very absorbing. It's very beautiful. But I'm talking differently right now, where you say everything that's on your mind, what all of your fears are, what all of your aspirations are, how you want to be, what's most important to you, you know, in terms of your own attitudes, in terms of working on issues that you're having some problems with. You just tell Bhagavan all of that. And then you check it out, like, you can talk to Bhagavan. It's your own psyche responding, but it responds with a lot of affirmation. You know, like when you ask questions, does this seem good? You know, or how should I be with this? And then listen to what comes. So just develop that real relationship with Ishwara as part of your day. You know, because that actually becomes, Bhagavan is always there to have that kind of inner conversation with and without words throughout the day. It just becomes kind of natural, you know. Just like if you're feeling some pressure from the little ones inside throughout the day, it's a split second, not even a split second, to go in and be with that, you know. And you don't have to be sitting in meditation for it. You can be walking around, you can be engaged, you can be doing dishes. It doesn't make any difference. Those inner relationships can always be tended. In the relationship with Bhagavan can always be tended, just in your daily life, as naturally taking things as prasad, and also in conversation. But that morning meditation and puja, what's so beautiful about it is it gives you space to set up the day, right? Instead of just rolling out of bed and moving right into all of the stuff that goes on in life, you have some time to yourself, you know, to bring into yourself your knowledge and your values and what's important, and to set yourself up for the day like that. It's very beautiful to do that. Puja is helpful for that, and so is just your meditative practice. So your puja can also be a walk in nature, you know. It doesn't have to be the actual performing of a ritual, but if you know how to do that and you're inclined that way, then that's something beautiful to do, you know. Same with chanting. Not everybody likes to chant, but some of us do, you know. And that's also very absorbing and beautiful, especially when you know the meaning. How do I know that I live my dharma? Is it the same as following my heart's, my longings, and my values? Well, your values and the following your heart and your longings. If those longings seem like just natural expressions of you, and there's nothing adharmic about them, and you're moving in that direction, then I'd say that's the swecha prarabdha karma. It's just your longings are in line with your prarabdha, you know. And if they aren't in line, it's kind of the prarabdha will kind of, and but they're still dharmic, you can strive, but the prarabdha will kind of shift you. So I would say, you're in line with your prarabdha and with dharma until you feel discomfort. When you feel discomfort, then that's a time to sit with myself, you know, and see what's going on inside. Because your prarabdha is completely natural to you. It is you, in a sense. If you extend yourself, in terms of the prarabdha, to a little bigger piece of Ishvara, the prarabdha is yourself. It is Ishvara, which includes your body, mind. So it's completely natural. It's already given. You already have it, you know. And it's yours in that unfoldment. And so there's something very, how would you call it? Very centering about accepting what is and being in the flow of your prarabdha. It's very centering because it's absolutely yours, you know. So it's not a fantasy. It's not something like spinning off into a fantasy world of what I want to be and what I want to become. It's actually very much more grounded than that. It's actually kind of what I am, you know, how this, that the way that this life is unfolding. And so I just have to center myself into the present, and also that asking, what do I really want? That's such a wonderful question. It's just between you and Bhagavan. What are my values? What do I really, really want? You know, and then see if your direction is in harmony with that. That's a beautiful meditation. You know, is your direction in harmony with that, or are you afraid of it, or just see what comes up, and then feel. That you can also feel when you get into what you really want, who you really are, not in terms of Brahman, but just in terms of this jiva, you know. And you can ask, is that right, you know? Is that right? And then why not let that happen? Do you have resistance to letting that happen? Are you afraid, you know, to let that happen? You can be afraid for a lot of reasons. Will Bhagavan support me? Will there be enough money? All this kind of thinking, all that kind of stuff. But if that is right, then let that be brave. Let that unfold. Without being afraid, let go of the fear. Which takes some courage, you know, because we have all kinds of fears. Because we haven't always been in this knowledge, and so we have a lot of fears that we have to be with and slowly let go of them and be brave, you know. So I remember, I think I mentioned how in India, the students that come to the teacher up in the Himalayas, first thing he does is you walk down to Madras and back. It'll only take you about three years or so. Go down Madras and back with nothing. Okay. That'll make you very brave. It'll make you brave because you'll see Bhagavan takes care of you. I'm not telling you to do that. Yeah, but nevertheless, it would be just to see, you know, that you are taken care of. So let's do one or two more. How to know when to have patience and when to take action? How to know when it is fear or being lazy, escape, being disconnected, that is preventing me from taking action? So how to know when to have patience and when to take action? Well, often you'd like to take action, but there's no action to take. You know, you want to take the action, but it's not really time because there's nothing there for you to do yet, you know. And that's the problem of the buddhi seeing in advance, you know. And what can I do now to make that happen? Well, there's nothing yet for you to do. So you have to be patient. But then the other is, am I not doing something that I want to do because of fear? Okay, so then a good thing is to really sit with that desire, you know, and you're feeling you're not ready to make a move. And you just ask, you get into a dialogue with yourself and Bhagavan, you know, and ask, is it okay to make this move now? And say, I'm feeling afraid. What is that fear based on? Is it because it's not the right time? Am I, You know, am I skirting my responsibilities by taking this action now at this time? Is it dharmic? All of these things. You have to go in and be with Ishwara, really. And that's why this kind of prayer, getting used to this kind of prayer, is so important, so that you get an inner go-ahead, that it's okay to give these things up now and do this, or whatever it happens to be. It's also when you give something up to do the next thing, you know, you're leaving something behind. Also, you're often leaving some security behind too, and yet there's a pull to do something else. So that pull will most likely win out in the end, but it takes some time before, when you recognize that pull and it's tenacious and you know that you're going in that direction, there still can be kind of confusion about when the time is right. Actually, when the time is right also happens. And then you can say things like, oh, now the time is right, now it's the right time to go. Or you can say, well, up to this time I was too afraid, or make all kinds of excuses. But what I really feel is that when the time is right, then everything inside and outside, you know, is in harmony. Mm-hmm. Nevertheless, there are fears there and resistance and worry, and that's why it's good to have these conversations with Bhagavan, you know, and to really sit with that desire and say, am I running away from something, or is this really what I want to do? Is this really what I want? And then just work with it until you get a total yes, this is. This is. And you might have had to tweak it a little bit. You might have added things onto it, you know, that are just like extra little bonuses or something. And just get down to what it actually is. And then follow that path as it opens up to you. That's why these inner dialogues, being with Ishwara, this prayer life, is so beautiful, so rewarding, that you're not alone. Even in your guidance, in what's guiding you, you're not alone. So to develop that relationship with Ishwara in whatever form, as an Ishta Devata, you know, or as a wisdom figure, whatever form Bhagavan takes, where you, that you feel that connection, or just as Ishwara, without any form. It's really good to foster all of that. Okay, we only have three. I want to stop now. Enough questions. So I'll have more satsang at five. I don't know, we might do something special, but Jenny, I'll let you know. Let me decide. Om Purnamadah Purnamidam Purnat Purnamudachyate Purnasya Purnamadaya Purnameva Vashishyate Om Shanti 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 Harihi Om Shri Gurupyo Namaha Harihi Om